If you have a question, you can raise your hand. Okay, so the first one will be Christian Chung. I think you can talk now.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, I have a question for Michael. So this is about the game theories. I want to just understand maybe just more generally, like, why is it that we would expect that these gauge theories should describe, like, is there a general principle or an intuitive way that we can see that we should write down these sorts of gauge theories to describe the low energy physics? Is there an intuition for which systems it might work for and which ones it might not? And then the second part would be like, when we write down the effective Hamiltonian, should we just kind of include all terms? Like you said something yesterday about, like, you know, you could think of it as a Landau type thing where you have to include all terms that are allowed and then you just kind of keep the lowest order ones. Is that the general philosophy for when you construct that effective Hamiltonian?
So your second question, can you hear me, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So for your second question, I think the answer is, at least the way I understand it, is yes, you should basically include all terms that are consistent with gauge invariance and I guess whatever symmetries you have. So I think that's the answer to your second question. Your first question about where the gauge theory comes from, I guess, or why we would expect it to be there. I don't know. I guess there are a couple, there are maybe two answers to that question. One of which I sort of touched on a little bit, which is that if you just look at the wave function, there's a kind of gauge redundancy in this projection scheme. So if you take this projected wave function and you try to like construct neighboring states, you can see you can do it by modifying the ansatz in a certain way. But when you do that, it's a many to one mapping and there's this gauge redundancy. So you can kind of see there a hint at some kind of gauge structure. You can probably go further with that and really try to argue that there are gauge fluctuations about that particular physical wave function. That's one way to argue for it, I guess. Maybe it's a little heuristic, but it gives you a sense for why there might be gauge theory fluctuations there. The other argument, I don't know if this really answers your question, but the kind of standard argument for how you derive the gauge theory, I didn't talk about at all in my lecture, which is that it's kind of a path integral approach. You take a spin model and you write it in terms of fermions, and you get a four fermion interaction, and then you put in a constraint, the single occupancy constraint using a Lagrange multiplier, and then you decouple the four fermion interaction using Hubbard-Strutanovich transformation. After a couple of manipulations like this, you get something that looks like a gauge theory. It looked very formal, but you can just, so then you get a path integral that looks like a gauge theory. Now the problem, so that gives you kind of a derivation of the gauge theory. The problem with it is that the gauge theory is kind of in the wrong limit. It's like extremely, sort of in the extreme strong infinite coupling limit instead of the weak coupling limit. And, so it's a little bit hard to make contact with the physical Hilbert space, but at the level of a path integral, that gives you another sort of intuition for why it's not crazy to get this emergent gauge theory.
Great. Yeah, that's really helpful. Thank you.
And that should be mentioned, by the way, in the references, some of the references I gave, like Shougan's book talks a little bit about that path integral approach, just a little bit. But if you want to learn more about it, you could start there and then follow the references. Some of the very first papers on this do it that way with a path integral approach.
Okay, thank you.
So the second one will be Tarong Grover. So I think you can talk now.
This question for Sangsik. Question is it a compact form of this matrix model you mentioned for the large n limit? Can one write down that matrix model explicitly? And relatedly, does the co-dimension expansion give some direct insight into the kind of some conjecture about that matrix model? Because you said it's hard to solve. That's the question.
Yeah, you can. So you can write down matrix model. So I hear my own echo. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of booming in the voice, but.
I cannot quite hear you, so.
Maybe you could turn down the volume on your computer. That might help.
Yeah, I saw you logged in with two devices, right?
Or maybe it's two devices. Oh yeah, you do have two logins. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Two sounds like.
Do I have two logins?
Yeah, maybe if you log out of one or turn down the volume.
Sorry.
Try that. That might be better already.
Okay, how about now?
Yeah, it looks better. Yeah.
Okay, so unlike the user matrix model, the one of the index around the forming surface is continuous index. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if you try to write down it as in the form of matrix model, mm-hmm. it has some fuzziness in contracting the continuous matrix index. Mm-hmm. And that fuzziness is order of 1 over n. So you can formally write down the matrix model. But I think no one has tried to solve that matrix model directly, I think.
I see. Yeah, is it related to some other matrix model that have been written in the past in, say, in string theory or something? Is it identical to something else which has been written in the past, or is it completely some new?
It looks quite new, given that one of the index came from continuous index.
Right, I see. And does the codimension expansion give some insight into something about this model, or is it hard to say anything?
Oh yeah, you can codimension expansion gives you the controlled expansion.
That I understand. I was wondering, can you say something? Does it give some insight into how would one solve this matrix model? I think that was the question.
In two dimension directly.
Right.
Yeah. So that we don't know how to solve the matrix model in two dimension directly.
Okay. Yeah, thank you.
Okay, next one will be Aaron Hui. I think you can talk now.
Hi, so I have a question for Michael. So I guess the place where I first heard about partons was in relationship with quarks and particle collisions and all of that. This parton construction that you described seem to be more about, say, in some loose sense, deconfinement of the gauge field that enforces this constraint by hand. Is that a correct way of thinking about the parton construction, or are there more subtleties?
I think that's one way to say it, is you put in this gauge field sort of to enforce the constraint. So this is this approach, as I mentioned before, I didn't really discuss, but there's this way to think about the constraint as being enforced by Lagrange multiplier, and then you get a gauge theory if you work in this path integral formulation. And then once you have that gauge theory, initially it looks like it's sort of in the very strong coupling limit, it looks like it might be confining, but then you argue that when you integrate out certain low energy degrees of freedom, like the fermions at short distances, then maybe the gauge coupling gets smaller and you get in the deconfined phase. So yes, I think you can think of it as somehow there's this gauge theory that enforces the constraint and becomes deconfined. The problem with that picture, I think that's perfectly fine, but I personally, it makes me nervous because I don't really, it seems a little formal. So I'm searching for something a little more concrete where you can really see it at the level of the Hilbert space, what's going on. But that's certainly one way to think about it, that, yeah. So the answer is yes. I think it's a fine way to think about it.
So a related follow-up, I guess, is there a natural way to understand the deconfinement? Because I would have expected the constraint to be, you know, it's strongly coupled and you need some magic to make it deconfine.
I think that's the tricky part. So in the large, in certain limits, you can kind of argue that this will work out. I think in the large n limit, if you have you replace SU2 spins with SUN spins, then you can argue, I don't know if there are any catches there, but you can kind of start to make an argument that you'll really get, you can get a weakly fluctuating gauge field and a deconfined gauge field. But yeah, it's a little bit mysterious, especially if you try to keep finite N. And so, yeah, it is mysterious. So that's part of the reason that I didn't present it that way.
I see. Thanks.
Okay, next one will be John McGreevy. I think you can speak now.
Hi. So, Michael, you mentioned some examples where you said the wave function you get from the parton construction is unphysical. I was hoping you could elaborate on what you
I wish I could remember them off the top of my head. So they're mentioned, I believe they're mentioned in the Balanced Savory Review article, but there are a couple examples. I think some of the, I can just tell you some of the vague parameters of those examples, but I don't remember the details. I think that in general, the biggest problem occurs with the gapless theories. So for example, maybe the pi flux liquid might, the pi flux state might be an example. I'm not sure if that's the one they mentioned, but in some of these gapless states, the wave function you get, you can convince yourself it's just extremely unlikely to be the right wave function because basically it's coming from, I mean, this projection construction is sort of a two-dimensional construction. And so it looks like at best you'll get something that looks like a critical point. If you try to calculate equal time correlation, it seems like at best you'll get something that's like a 2D critical point, whereas you want something that looks like a 3D critical point. So it somehow doesn't have the right dimensionality. That's what I vaguely remember. So yeah, I can't give you specific examples, but I think it happens because I just don't remember them, but I think it happens in the gapless states. That's where it most clearly breaks down. Even in gap states, I'm sure it could break down. I mean, as many of you probably know, even the Laughlin states, if you go to very large N, you know, they are not in the right phase. They're not in the, you know, they get into this Wigner crystal phase, right? So, you know, almost any wave function you write down, I think will generally have that issue. Like it seems too much to expect that it's like in the right, maybe the Laughlin states are morally kind of the right wave functions, but at a microscopic level, at large values of K, they're kind of in the wrong phase, right? And I think that's kind of that kind of thing can happen, I think, in the projective construction too, although I don't know specific examples.
So if I understand correctly, by unphysical you mean just not the ground state of a particular microscopic Hamiltonian that we happen to care about.
For the gapless case, again, I don't know if we can prove anything, but they seem like very, if they're the ground states of anything, it would have to be super fine tuned. It doesn't seem very natural because it's not going to be a 3D critical point because somehow the exponents aren't right. And so, if it's a ground state of a microscopic Hamiltonian at all, it would have to be a very strange one whose equal time correlations look like a 2D gapless point or something. It would have to be kind of strange. I don't know if anyone's proven that it can't be the ground state of some local Hamiltonian, but it just seems like if it is the ground state of any, it may not be. And if it is, it would have to be a very strange, probably finely tuned Hamiltonian.
Thanks.
Next one will be Dem Song. I think you can speak now.
Yeah, this is a question for Sam Six. In the large N limit, you say that there is a field that carries two indices, and one of the index is theta, the angle. I want to ask if theta runs the whole Fermi surface or only near one patch or two patches.
So, in principle, it runs over the whole Fermi surface, but the one that are relevant, say for electron spectral function at a given momentum points, runs around that particular patch. So that is a sign that patch theory is still justified. So it's kind of contribution from large angle is dynamically suppressed because you give some hard cutoff.
Yeah, my second question, last question is the following. So you say that, so in this patch picture, fermions near different patches almost do not couple to each other. Is it the same for bosons? That means if bosons that move in different direction, do they also do not couple very well with each other?
That's right. They can couple with each other only very close to the zero momentum. But the phase space volume in that region relative to the remaining phase space volume goes to zero. So that in the low energy limit, bosons also at different momentum are also decoupled, essentially.
Thank you.
So I think Xie also has a question, so you can ask.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, Michael. So I want to ask about Kitaev's model. So Kitaev's honeycomb model in two dimension, I think people, it's regarded as an exact parton construction, but in that case, it's like some of the Maranas are the matter, and some of the Maranas make up the gauge field. Is that what we should do when we consider how to match the Hilbert space to make the parton approach like more reasonable?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. If that's a great example, I should have mentioned, as Shay was saying, this Kitaev honeycomb model can be regarded as a model where the, in some sense, the parton construction is exact, but it's a bit weird. Like you said, the Majoranas, you use Majoranas to write your physical spins, and some of the Majoranas are kind of actually become the gauge field. So yeah, I mean, let's see how to interpret your question. I don't know, maybe one interpretation is there a way to generalize that Kitaev's construction to really generate like spin liquids, like that Z2 spin liquid, for example, right? Yeah. Can one do that? I don't know how to do that. Maybe it's possible, but it's not, I personally don't know how to generate spin liquids. So it seems like you can generate some states that way, but I don't know if you can get like all the sort of symmetries, particularly spin rotation and lattice symmetries that you get with this parton construction. So,
like this,
but it's, yeah.
This is an example of Z2.
Yeah, it's Z2, but I guess when I say spin liquid, it doesn't have like, I don't know how to make it have, make that kind of construction give you something where you have SU2 invariance and where let's say you have an odd number of spin 1/2 per unit cell. Like that would be very interesting.
Yeah.
A system with an odd number of spin 1/2 per unit cell and spin rotation and translation invariance. Mm-hmm. And the parton construction can do that, but Kitaev's kind of exact construction, I don't know how to quite make it do that. Maybe there's a way. Mm-hmm. That would be very interesting because it certainly is, it's an exact construction. Right. So it's very nice.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, actually, I just want to add one quick comment. So from the ordinary pattern Michael introduced, you can also get Kitaev's results just by putting choosing very specific pairing answers.
Mm-hmm. I didn't see that.
I saw, John, do you want to ask another question, right?
Yes, please. So I have a question for Meng.
Yes.
So I guess it has two parts. The first one is sort of a remedial question, which is, you mentioned that when introducing these defects, mm-hmm. it's only when the action of the defect is of infinite order that the particles are localized. Is that correct? And can you explain why a little more why that's the case?
I will say that's more like a sufficient condition. I'm not saying that that's the only way that it works, but at least in this particular example, we need infinite order for this defect symmetry action because when we say the particle is localized, it cannot move anywhere. But if the order is finite, it means that after you go some sufficiently long step, this excitation comes back to the same superselection sector. So there is a physical process that takes this particle, say, 10 steps away from where it was. So in that case, we won't say it's localized. It just that it moves with very long steps. No, that. it has a very small mass, a small velocity. So to make it really immobile, we need infinite order so that it never returns to the same type of excitation under condensation.
Okay, I see.
And that's just one way to get this kind of fractonic particles. I mean, there are other ways. For example, maybe the symmetry is finite order like Z2, but you have infinite number of symmetries like the planar subsystem symmetry, then they sit on different planes. So each time you move it, the representation of this particle under this infinite large Z2 symmetry changes, that's also fine.
Okay, good, I see. Then the second part of the question is, you mentioned examples where the walls mix electric charges and dipole moments, and you also mentioned examples where it mixes electric charges and magnetic charges. So I guess more generally, there's some bigger picture with where it acts on some larger lattice involving all of these things and also magnetic dipoles. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Although I will just consider a very general U1 that there's like one line in my in one of the final slides, but I guess I was rushing to the end. So I guess in the very general case, we can consider like U1, just n U1 gauge symmetries, and there are n electric charges and n magnetic charges, and they can be mixed in arbitrary ways as long as we preserve the commutation relations between E and B fields. I think that group is like SP2n, Z. I think that's the largest one can go.
Oh, but that doesn't include dipoles, right?
So at least the way that I thought about it, I'll just regard dipole as a separate U1 symmetry. I'm not sure whether
that's
the most general one can do. It's not 100% clear that that includes magnetic dipoles, but I would try to view it as just a separate U1 with some kind of statistical interaction with the other U1s, and that may do it. I'm not entirely sure, but
okay, I see the idea. Thanks.
Okay, next one will be Song Yangpu. I think you can speak now.
Hello, can I be heard? Hello, I have a question for Michael. So in the pattern construction, can the ground state have a long abelian statistics? And if so, what is the general condition?
And what have non-abelian statistics? Can you say again?
So in the pattern construction, so the ground state we obtain, can it have a long abelian statistic?
Yes. So at least in the quantum Hall case, that's the main case I know where this happens. I mentioned this quickly, but probably wasn't very clear. One of the papers I referenced at the beginning, it's the second paper by Xiaogan Wen, is all about this. So, and basically the idea is that it's sort of what I mentioned, that if you write an electron as a product of three fermionic partons, you keep the sort of symmetry between the partons, you actually have an SU3 symmetry that you can act on those three parton flavors. And so then you end up with partons coupled to an SU3 gauge field. Or more generally, if you had K partons, you might have SUK gauge field. And then if your partons are in like a integer quantum Hall state, then when you kind of, they generate a, if you imagine integrating them out, they generate some kind of SUK non-abelian Chern-Simons theory. And so, so when Xiaogan discusses this in his paper, it can happen even in pretty simple examples. Basically, you need, I think to get something non-abelian, you need it to be SUK Chern-Simons theory, but it has to be level 2 or larger. Level 1 is not enough. So that means that you need, in this context, it means that you need something that fills 2 Landau levels, not a single Landau level. So if you had some number of partons that fill 2 Landau levels, let's say, then you would get like an SUK gauge theory level two SUK gauge theory, non-abelian Chern-Simons theory, and that's non-abelian. So he discusses that in his paper. And you can write down the wave functions. They're just products of sort of integer quantum Hall wave functions, but now they're integer quantum Hall wave functions that fill up, let's say, two Landau levels instead of just a single Landau level.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I see Aaron Hui's hand is still raised. Do you have another question to ask? Hello? Okay, I see. Okay, there's another person, Porkman Tan. You can ask now.
Hi, do you hear me? Yeah, I have a question for Michael. So this question is related to what you discussed previously about the counterexamples where the spin state may not be physical. So my question is related to, rather related to H0. So for the Hamiltonian, for the parton, is there a general recipe that tells us that H0 is rather microscopic or local and physical? I mean, if I begin with Heisenberg Hamiltonian, it seems like I have a pretty good recipe of deriving the H0 for the parton using the Slaver fermion approach. But for example, for the quantum Hall example that you did earlier today, it seems like H0 comes out from thin air and it leads a leap of faith to be taken in order to treat H0 as the Hamiltonian for the parton and proceed with the stuff you mentioned. So is it generally true for most parton construction that H0 can be treated as a microscopic Hamiltonian, a physical Hamiltonian? Or, and this is my question.
So H0, okay, yeah. So I think maybe you're asking, so the way I presented it, H0 is something you start with. You just pick an H0 and then that gives you a candidate state. But I think what you're referring to is the sort of mean field point of view where you start with a spin Hamiltonian and then you do some mean field approximation and then, you know, you write the spin in terms of fermions and then you do some kind of mean field decoupling and you get a quadratic fermion Hamiltonian and maybe you try to solve some self-consistency condition to find it. So people do that second approach for sure. And in the quantum Hall case, I think you can do that. I don't know to what extent you can derive that H naught that I wrote down, but you can certainly imagine doing the same decoupling thing. And I think that is in one of Xiaogan's papers, where you just write the fermion as a product of three partons, and then you get a six parton interaction. You get six parton interaction from just the hopping term, and then you get even higher parton interactions from electron interaction terms. And then you imagine doing this decoupling procedure to get some quadratic thing. But in the end of the day, it just becomes, I don't think it gains you much. At the end of the day, you more or less just, if I remember correctly, you just assert a particular value for H naught. I'm not sure whether you can derive it from some self-consistency condition, in at least in a quantum Hall case. I'm not sure. But in answer to your question, that you do take it to be local. It should be a local thing. That's important.
I see. But conceptually, using the first approach, it seems like we are more confident that the H0 that we so-called derived, quote-unquote derived, is local and physical. But in the second approach that you described, you just come up with such an H0, it seems like we are less confident that it indeed corresponds to some microscopic Hamiltonian. Is this right?
Well, my view is in neither approach is it clear that H0 has anything to do with the physical Hamiltonian. I mean, even in the mean field approach, it makes it sound like you're doing something physical, but it's such a incredible approximation to introduce these big fermions and then decouple. I mean, you're doing something very dramatic there. So my point of view is neither approach. The first one gives you an illusion that you're doing something well controlled, but you're not really. So I think that's why I don't view it as something where you start with a spin Hamiltonian and derive H naught. I think it's, my personal view is it's more like just a way to construct candidate states. Think of it as a variational approach at some level. And then you have to check whether those states are good for whatever Hamiltonian you're interested in. But I'm not sure whether we can really view it as something where you can start with a microscopic Hamiltonian and really construct the corresponding H naught. I don't know. I'm not confident in that, even with the first approach. So that's why I didn't emphasize it, because I think there isn't really any way to go from a microscopic Hamiltonian to H naught. The best you can hope for is to go the reverse and take an H naught and then use it as a variational parameter and see whether which H naught is the best for some microscopic model.
I see. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you.
So we are running out of time, but I see there are still three people raising their hand. So let's take the last three questions. Matt, you can speak now.
I have a question for Michael. For the Z2 gauge theory example, I was wondering why couldn't you just start with like an atomic insulator, like the way she has started with a paramagnet, in order to build the... Yeah.
Okay, so I was trying to follow the slave fermion construction. So in that sense, the gauge field that you pick, you're not allowed to just pick any gauge field you want. You have to pick the gauge field that somehow, you want to include all gauge fluctuations about your state. So that means you need to include all group elements, all the symmetry transformations that preserve your ansatz. So if you picked a really simple ansatz, like I think maybe like one, for example, that's doesn't have any pairing term, then you're certainly going to have U1 symmetry. You're going to have U1.
Right. But,
and then you would get a U1 gauge theory. So you need the pairing term. And then once you put in the pairing term, then it starts to get tricky to make, you also want it to have all the lattice symmetries. And so I don't understand this very well, but my impression is you have to choose the pairing term in a particular way to both break the symmetry down to Z2, which, and to also keep all the lattice symmetries. And so that example I gave you is one that's been constructed to do both those things. It has all the lattice symmetries, but it still fully breaks the symmetry down to Z2. Because sometimes even with a pairing term, there can be a U1 symmetry that's kind of hidden. That's discussed in Shaogan's book. It looks like you've broken it to Z2, but you haven't. So you have to be careful. That example really breaks it all the way down to Z2, but it preserves all the lattice symmetries.
Mm-hmm. I just saw that in your model, you didn't have any chemical potential terms. So.
Yeah, none of those models needed them because I think the chemical potential is zero, basically. I think to make it at half filling, if I remember correctly, they didn't need it. But it's possible I made a mistake, but I think that's right.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so next one will be Christian Chang. You can speak now.
Hi, thanks. Can you hear me? I have another question. Thanks for taking another one. So I'm just trying to get some more intuition for the gauge fields. And primarily, you know, this is a low energy effective theory, but I'm wondering if is there any way or are there any particular models where we can really try to think about what the gauge fluctuations represent in like the original spin model? Somehow, like I don't know. I just feel like I don't really have much.
Yeah. So that's something I mentioned. I had at the beginning, sort of. So, but there is a way to construct microscopic wave functions that correspond to gauge fluctuations, and the way you do it is you change your ansatz from Tij to Tij e to the I theta ij. And that gives you a new ansatz, and then you project the ground state, you get a new wave function. Mm-hmm. And the assertion, well, first of all, you can see it has a gauge redundancy. That's sort of what I talked about. So it starts to look like a gauge fluctuation, but the assertion is you can even say exactly what that corresponds to in terms of the effective theory. And basically using that approach, I think this is also mentioned in Shaogan's book, you can create like a Z2 flux. So there's a prescription to create a Z2 flux excitation, what we would call a Vison, in the spin model. And it's basically by changing your ansatz from Tij to Tij e to the I theta ij, and then making theta ij equal pi on some like branch cut that goes from a plaquette off to infinity. And that prescription creates a pi flux a Vison excitation. So it gives you a microscopic wave function for the Vison excitation. And if you can really see that it's a reason that it's a part, that it's a local excitation, and that this branch cut is unphysical. Like there's no, the density matrix, the branch cut can be moved.
Right. It's like a Dirac string or something.
Exactly. You can show that. That's kind of the gauge invariance, gauge redundancy I mentioned. You can make a gauge transformation to kind of move it elsewhere. Uh-huh. So this is a real physical excitation, and then you can really create it and study it.
But like in a, if you had a, like a gapless case where you have like a photon, then like that could create some long range interaction, but is there any physical picture of that in terms of
Yeah, I think the same thing can be done, but what you would be creating there is, has less of a clear meaning. It's not like a localized, what you can create is, you can kind of create a pattern of gauge flux in your system by following this prescription. By introducing this theta ij, you can kind of, roughly speaking, create flux throughout your system. Or you could create a very small flux in some region. Of course, you don't expect that to really behave like a quasi-particle, but it still lets you access kind of the gauge degree of freedom in some sense. So I don't know if that answers your question, but you can create, you can kind of, so I think the short answer is all the excitations in the effective theory, whether you're talking about spin-on excitations or kind of gauge field excitations, I think we have microscopic pictures for them in terms of the wave function. So there is a corresponding wave function, but the picture isn't perfect. Like I don't think, you know, this projection operation isn't unitary. And so, for example, all kinds, I don't think you get orthogonal states and there's some issues like that, but there is some kind of crude picture for these gauge fluctuations and spin-on excitations in terms of the microscopic wave functions. And that is discussed a bit in Shaogun's book, although mostly in the gap case.
Yeah, thank you so much.
So the last question will come from Dashi Doshi. You can speak now.
Hi, I have a question for Meng Cheng. So in your talk, you said that one way to get fractal models is by gauging the dipole symmetry in general theory. Right. So is there something interesting or unexpected that happens if you gauge higher, like theories with higher moment symmetries, like quadrupole or octuple, or is it just exact analog of this procedure?
I mean, at least technically, it's a similar procedure to gauge these higher moment symmetries. At least the way that I think about it, you can do it kind of in a hierarchy. You can, once you gauge a dipole symmetry, the next one, quadrupole, becomes, you know, more or less like an ordinary symmetry in this already fractonic Ewan-Gage theory, and then you can keep doing this. So you're just imposing more and more conservation laws on the theory. So, you know, at least in terms of what kind of phases you get, it's, if you just do these and you're more or less they are the same phase, but the physics could be different. I don't know off the top of my head, you know, for example, what is the dispersion of photons in these, if you gauge higher moment symmetries, or whether these theories actually are stable, because that's something I didn't talk about. You know, one should ask whether the series suffers from non-perturbative instability or whether the charges are actually deconfined. So these questions, some of them were discussing at least one of the practical's papers. So at least just to summarize, so at least in terms of, you know, what you do to gauge it, I think there's not much difference, but the resulting series could have different dynamics just because you're imposing more symmetries. And there are other aspects of these problems. For example, there are some recent works on the dynamical phases in systems with, say, higher moment symmetries. And in that case, depending on what symmetries impose, you could get very different non-equilibrium dynamical behavior.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so the Q&A session is over. Let us thank all the speakers today, and also thank for your attendance.